to work with something quite various, but I think there has been some advancement in back reaction. Now, I'll start quite briefly summarizing what the dark energy issue is, and I'll talk about the effect of inhomogeneities, and then come back to how these two might be related. There are by now a large number of observations which provide indirect evidence for the acceleration of the universe, but still the only statistically significant direct evidence are the luminosity distances by one supernova. So what we observe is that we measure the redshift and the flux of some supernova, and then we interpret these observations in the context of a model of the universe that is completely homogeneous on us. So then we can relate redshifts to distances and to expansion rates, and we can reconstruct the expansion history. So a homogeneous monastic universe obeys the Friedmann Prinzl Walker equation. The acceleration, so from the acceleration equation, we see that if the universe contains only normal matter with non-negative energy density, non-negative pressure, then the acceleration necessarily decelerates. Then using this acceleration equation together with the energy moment from conservation law, we can obtain the Hubble law, like have spatial curvature. And the behavior of the spatial curvature actually follows as a consistency condition between these equations. And the problem is that if you take whole dark matter and baryons, the pressure is zero, the energy density goes like 1/3, so there is no way of getting acceleration. Phrased another way, the energy density drops too fast. And in the context of these equations, you can always fix the problem by simply adding a component to the energy density which decays more slowly than dust, meaning that it has negative pressure. And you can always take what is observed, subtract out the seen baryonic, seen and inferred baryonic and dark matter, and then call the rest dark energy. And there are by now dozens of different models of dark energy. In other words, models of getting negative pressure. But the real problem is not that the pressure is negative, but why has the acceleration started recently, or why has the energy density, apparent energy density in dark energy become equal to the energy density in dark matter in the recent past, in the last few billion years. For example, if you take your favorite inflationary model, tune down the parameters, and there you have your dark energy. It's no problem. Or you can just take the cosmological constant, which is the simplest possibility. It fits the data. Okay, it's well motivated. And none of the dark energy models improve in any real way on the cosmological constant. And they don't solve this coincidence problem. Why has this happened recently? Some possible reasons for this coincidence in quotation marks, because if you know the reason, then it's of course not a coincidence. If there is a reason. One is that it really is a coincidence. So that, for example, if the theory of quantum gravity gives a unique ground state with a well-defined sum of the cosmological constant, the vacuum energies, then maybe this just happens to be of the order of the matter density today. This is maybe not totally as crazy as it sounds, because the energy density, the energy scale of matter in the universe today was 1 million electron volts. And so you can numerologically see a connection that this is dV squared divided by m prime. As it's widely expected that some new physics will be seen at the dV scale, then perhaps one could really get a vacuum energy from fundamental, of this order from fundamental physics. And of course, this formula suggests the neutrino seesaw mechanism, and this is the scale of the neutrino math fitting, so maybe there could be a relation. A second possibility is that theory of quantum gravity does not have a unique vacuum. There are different vacuum with different vacuum energies realized in different parts of the universe, and then naturally we can't observe those places where the vacuum energy is positive and much bigger than the matter density, because the universe would have started accelerating very early and galaxies would not have formed. Likewise, it's negative, and the absolute magnitude is very large, and the universe could have collapsed very early. And these two explanations have in common that if they are true, then we are likely not to know that in the foreseeable future. Because then you really need to have the theory of quantum gravity and know what are its vacuum states, or have some sort of principle that allows you to discuss this issue in a low energy effective theory, such as supersymmetry, which cuts off contributions to the Higgs masses of our systems. The second thing that they have in common is that there is no dynamics involved. They just find out the vacuum state or the vacuum states and possibly advise on selection principles. So the third possibility is that there is a dynamical explanation. And if so, the simplest possibility is that it's related to the dynamics we actually see in the universe. Of course, this doesn't have to be the case. For example, dark matter and dark energy can have some complicated dynamics which are only very weakly related to the visible universe. But when we see something that we don't know how to explain, then we should first try to connect it to other things that we have seen and to things that we understand, rather than make up something completely unknown to explain this new observation. So what has happened in the late universe, say, after BBM? There is a fairly qualitative change, which is the transition from matter radiation domination to matter domination around redshift of between 3,000 or 4,000. And this, of course, has been used in connection with this problem by having tracker models, which lie dormant as long as the universe is radiation dominated. Then when the universe becomes matter dominated, they awake, start tracking the matter density, catch up with it, because their energy density rises relative to the matter density, and they automatically have negative pressure. The problem, there are two problems, namely that all of these models are phenomenological, so we don't know really where they come from. And the second problem is actually the same as the first, namely that they don't explain why this happens around, why the universe begins to accelerate around 10 billion years. Because there's both measured in time and in the more and redshift, there is a big, there is a long time between the matter radiation inequality and today. So why didn't the field start dominating a redshift of 100 or 1,000? So that's why doesn't they come to trillion years until it dominates? Now, later plot is the last scattering, which I don't think anybody has tried to use as a trigger mechanism. In the later universe, the most visible and clear qualitative change is the growth of structure. And we know that the first bound objects are formed at least at a redshift of 10 or 20, and in supersymmetric CDM, the first object, bound objects form a redshift of between 40 and 60 or so. And then, of course, we have increasingly complex structure. This is still far from the redshift of 0.5 or around there, less than 1, where the acceleration has been observed to start. But there actually is a preferred time for structure formation, which is in the late universe. Namely, that in cold dark matter scenario, the size of the collapsed objects relative to the horizon size grows as structure formation proceeds, so you have larger and larger structures. And this, until this saturates, and this saturation happens for the amount of matter variance we have in the universe, the matter domain, it would happen in around 10 to 100 billion years. So I'll get back to this. I'll get back to this in more detail later. And what we don't produce, this is a trigger mechanism, just like matter radiation inequality introducing some field which is sensitive to the inhomogeneity in the universe and then picks up as universe because inhomogeneous. But it's also possible to look at this, the effect of inhomogeneities themselves. It's known as back reaction. And very simply defined, back reaction, means that the average, if you take a domain of spacetime, you take any manifold and then you take a domain there, and you look at how does the volume of this manifold evolve, how does the average energy density of this domain evolve, and so on, then the evolution is not given, is different from the evolution of a corresponding domain that would be completely smooth, corresponding in the same average initial conditions. And heuristically, this can be understood by saying from the fact that Einstein equation is nonlinear in the metric. So usually the justification for the Friedman Roberts-Walker equations is that when you look at the universe in sufficiently large areas, about 100 megaparsecs and up, then the universe is very homogeneous and isotropic. What you're doing then is that you're looking at the average, you're taking the average of the metric, plugging it into the Einstein tensor. What you should be doing is plugging the inhomogeneous metric into the Einstein tensor, then taking the average. And of course, these two procedures are not equivalent. In other words, average quantities do not satisfy the Einstein equation. In other words, the behavior of the average quantities in the universe is not described by the primary matter-Walker equations. And like many things in astrophysics and cosmology, this was first discussed in a Soviet journal in 1963 by Shirokov and Fisher. But the first detailed discussion was given by George Ellis in 1983, who termed this the fitting problem. That is, if you have some in the inhomogeneous universe, how do we find the average model? How do we find the model which best describes the average behavior of this? And for simple cases, one can actually look at this thing exactly. But I first want to discuss the different assumptions that go into the Friedman-Spencer-Walker, use of the Friedman-Spencer-Walker, which are usually implicit on the next. The first is that all the observables can be computed from an average scale factor. So that's all you need to do. Just take a scale factor, compute it, then you compute luminosity distances and angular diameter distances and so on from this average scale factor. And it is, and this assumption, it is not at all obvious that it is true. For example, George Ellis also pointed out that, for example, if you think about the propagation of light, then in the Friedman-Spencer-Walker universe, the curvature of the Riemann tensor, the Friedman-Spencer-Walker universe is conformally flat. So the Weyl tensor is zero, and you have only the Ricci tensor. But when you look at light, which is traveling through the real universe, it mostly travels in the vacuum, and only rarely hits some matter. So it's mostly actually from an environment where the Ricci tensor is zero and the Weyl tensor is not. Now, by now, there are a number of papers which have looked at this. And for example, there were papers published last year in the Astrophysical Journal doing calculations. So this is not something that is obvious and known and trivial. And they found that in certain conditions, you do this. If you look at inhomogeneous space-time, you do get the difference. You have different effects which cancel each other out, and you can look at the average scale. So this is just something to bear in mind. The second is that the behavior of this average scale factor is given by the Friedman-Spencer-Walker equation. And the third assumption is that the inhomogeneities evolve according to linear perturbation theory around the average. And I will keep to this first assumption. So we normally discuss how the average metric is, or the average scale factor we have, but I will be relaxing these two. So it's possible to look back reaction exactly in simple cases. So let's take a universe which is only dust, so called dark matter and baryons. And for technical reasons, I'm going to assume that the dust is irrotational. Then the metric can be written in a simple form where this is now vectorial function subject to the constraint of irrotationality. And then you can look at the Einstein equation and you get out these equations for the expansion. So these are equations. So these are local equations and exact equations. So if you have any domain, then this theta is the expansion rate of the local volume element. So it tells you how the local volume element, how the volume is changing if the shape remains constant. And in the Friedman-Spencer-Walker case, this is the three times the Hubble. Then you have, this is the square of the shear. So shear tells you what is the expansion like in different directions. So if you have a ball which expands faster in the towards the poles, it's flattened out with the shear. The rotationality would be expecting some this kind of an expansion, or this kind of movement, and this is not, that is not. So this is the analog of the Friedman-Spencer-Walker acceleration equation. This would give in the Friedman-Spencer-Walker case three times a dot dot divided by a. And we see that sigma squared is positive. We see that the acceleration is negative at every point in space, as you would expect from the fact that gravity is attractive. So if you have some lumps of matter and then gravity should slow down there. Then you have the analog of the Hubble law and then the conservation. And this 3-3 is the local spatial curvature. And looking at this equation, you see that the deceleration is negative. Acceleration is negative. The expansion decelerates everywhere. So you might think that from this it trivially follows that the average acceleration is also negative. However, this conclusion is false. These are the three benefits of water equations. Once again, so this describes the evolution of a completely homogeneous and isentropic space. Now, if you take the space under that, it's the third layer, so you have dust, which is irrotational, but otherwise can have any homogeneities, then and take the average of the equations that I showed you there. Yes. So there is a new term, Q, which contributes positively to the acceleration. And then you have the average spatial curvature, which behaves differently from the three benefits of work. And so the scale factor here is defined simply as the volume of the hypersurfaces of constant proper times of the spatial volume to the power of 1/3. So there is no assumption of homogeneity. The domain can be of any shape. And now the effect of inhomogeneity isn't contained in this Q, which consists of two parts. First, you have the variance of the expansion rate. Not this is always positive. And then you have the contribution of the shear, which is always negative. Here I have just shown what the averaging operation is. You just integrate the quantity A over the spatial hypersurface, and then you divide by the volume. And now you see that if Q is positive, more positive than this, than the contribution, the energy density, then the acceleration is positive. And also you see that because Q contributes negatively here, if the expansion rate accelerates, then this must compensate. The behavior of the spatial curvature must compensate here so that these two equations are consistent. And in fact, if you look at the integrability equation between these two conditions, you see that the spatial curvature is directly to Q. So this does not behave as in the free form of the work. Now,
so how are those equations arrived at? Is there some assumption about the size of Q relative to other parameters?
No. So what you do is you take the metric that I showed. So you take this metric and assume that vorticity is zero. You get these equations. Then you have to take the average of these equations.
So it really is just the averaging of those equations done in that way.
Yeah, absolutely. It's absolutely nothing else. So and this is an exact, these are exact equations. There's no assumption about perturbation theory or anything.
But obviously, if Q is smaller, its effects are small.
Exactly.
Cannot change the sign or.
Yeah, that's right. So this is.
Well, the thing is that a Q can be bigger. That's why, obviously, if Q is small, it doesn't do much.
Yeah.
Q
so is bigger. So this calculation was done first in the Newtonian case in 1995 by Buchert and Elex, and these Buchert equations were developed in 1999 by Thomas Buchert. And this, I think, this calculation should be in every cosmology textbook because. Here you can really see how you quantify the domain of validity of the Freeman and Metzger equations, which is usually not discussed. And here you indeed see that if the variance of the expansion rate is small and the shear is small, then you get the Freeman and Metzger equations.
So,
you want to say that somehow this kind of effect of RW evolution is the one we observe with supernova types?
No, I said earlier that I'm not going to discuss that issue. So that was assumption number one, that everything can be calculated from the average scale, from the average scale. Whether or not, I mean, of course, what you measure for when you measure luminosity distances, you measure redshifts and fluxes. Our other redshifts and fluxes in the real, you have to take into account the inhomogeneity and the observations. It's a different issue. For example, there was a paper by Gasparini, Bonvin, and Ruf Zürer from the University of Geneva, where they looked at the linearly perturbed Freeman and Walker signals. And they calculated not the average scale factor, but the luminosity distance, taking into account these perturbations. So that's different from what I'm doing. I mean, of course, that is also something that you have to check, but I'm being very conservative. I'm just saying, what is the real evolution of the average delta?
Right. So there's still something, I mean, maybe you'll explain it, but yeah. It's just if Q is more positive than the average of rho, it's clearly double dot positive. But yeah. Then what stops a runaway effect? I mean, how can you get that when the equations show it's in general negative?
Okay.
And where it's counterintuitive, but it's so counterintuitive.
I'll give an example.
Sorry, Andrew.
Why are you saying that the equation shows the length of the time is in general negative?
Well, that one doesn't, but the previous one does.
So the question is, does this make physical sense? Is there some sense in which the scale factor is the wrong quantity to look at or something? Because this seems, you know, that it seems paradoxical, or they didn't even seem that it's obviously wrong.
No, why are you surprised that if you take nonlinear equations and you average, take some approximation, this approximation will not be good in general situations?
This is not an approximation.
This is not an approximation. No. The approximation of setting Q to zero, usually done, is valid when Q is small. If Q is not small, then you have to solve the exact equation, which you were doing here.
You would be surprised how much resistance there is to this.
The only resistance that I can imagine is that we sort of know in our universe that Q is small.
I'll try to explain, because for example, there have been a number of papers criticizing back reaction approach, and for the back reaction of sub-horizon perturbations, so perturbations which are smaller than our horizon, and all of these papers are rather incorrect or misleading. And for example, it has been argued that because the local expansion rate, local acceleration is always decelerating, then the average expansion cannot accelerate. And it may even seem to be very odd, counterintuitive, but once I explain it in 10 minutes, you would say that this is obvious. And I would say that now that the average expansion can accelerate because there are regions which are collapsing. And you will see that this is the simplest thing in the world. It is known that I have the assumption number three that inhomogeneity is evolved according to linear perturbations of state relation theory around the average. And it's of course well known that if you take linear perturbations around the Friedman and Mertz Walker model, then when the density consists of order one, the behavior doesn't anymore follow the linear equation. And the simplest treatment that people usually use in structural formation and so on is to look at the spherical collapse model. So there's a spherically symmetric region, and then you look at the how this region behaves. And the average behavior of the region is then turned out to be something given exactly by an overdense Friedman and Mertz Walker. So this region behaves like an independent. And this statement breaking down is also true not just for perturbations around the Friedman and Mertz Walker equations, but for the equations themselves. So if you have perturbations, large perturbations in a large fractional space, then the corrections for the Friedman and Mertz Walker equations are large and you can no longer neglect. So I will now try to discuss this using the simplest possible the toy model to explain how this works. So that in the real universe there are underdensities and overdensities. So there is a union of one underdense region and one overdense region. They both tend to be spherical, so I don't want to use the spherical collapse model. And for simplicity, I will take the underdense region to be completely empty. And the expansion is proportional to the time, and this is not crucial. One can also take any other underdense region, but it's just not a thing. And for an overdense region, the scale factor can be parameterized in terms of the development and the phi. So first the expansion starting from zero, just the big bang, the expansion expands, it slows down. At phi equals pi, it turns around and starts to collapse. And then at phi equals 2 pi, you have a singularity. And usually, this behavior is cut off by hand at 1.55 and to assume that the collapse stabilizes. Because in the real universe, the matter is neither a perfect ideal fluid nor spherically symmetric, and these two effects will stabilize the system, the finite size. And the phi is related to time by the simplicity equation. So for this simple model, the overall volume is just the sum of the volumes in these two regions, so the overall scale factor is some of the volumes of our monster. the Hubble rate, defined like this, where this is now the overall scale factor, is just the weighted sum of the Hubble rate of the two regions. So the volume in region 1 times the Hubble rate in region 1 plus the volume in the overdense region times the Hubble rate in the overdense. I'll put the Hubble rates here in case you want to have a concrete idea, a bit more concrete idea of this. So the overdense region, the Hubble rate, is 1 over p, in the underdense region, is 4. Then, as the deceleration parameter, usually defined as a dot top divided by a times minus 1 over h. And here you have one contribution, so you have sort of the weighted sum, the underdense region and overdense region, but then you have an extra term which depends on the variance of the expansion rate. So this is the extra term that comes from the Q term that I showed you. And behavior of Q in this toy model is as follows. So this is the expansion development angle. So from 0 to pi, the overdense region expands and slows down. Then from pi to 1.55, where I have got this up, this collapses. And there is only one free parameter then in this toy model, which is the relative size of the regions, which I have fixed to get the same final deceleration parameter as in the lambda CDM. So this is lambda, omega lambda 0.7 among matter 0.3. And so in lambda CDM, the deceleration parameter starts from the matter dominated value 1/2, then it smoothly goes negative and eventually asymptotes to minus 1. In this, what happens in this toy model is that the contribution of the overdense region slows the expansion down. But because, and this is especially visible after the collapse started when this contribution is actually negative. However, because the relative size of the underdense region, which expands faster, is constant, is growing, then the contribution of this will eventually go down, and eventually the overdense region will start to dominate, and the expansion rate rises. So here you see the first the collapsing region, this decelerates the expansion, and then you have the underdense region catching. And so even though there is a limit on the possible biggest possible expansion rate. So in free parameter Walker models, the Q is bounded from below by minus 1 if you don't violate the null energy condition or do something strange or modify gravity or something. But here there is no lower limit on Q. Q can be as negative as you want. And so sort of analogy which would explain how this works is how it's possible for the acceleration to be arbitrarily fast, even though the expansion rate has a maximum limit. I mean, no, you cannot really expand up than this. Instead, if you want to improve the employment statistics for a country, but you have an upper limit on how fast you can find jobs for people, then all you need to do is take the people for whom you have the most difficulty finding jobs and excise them from the statistics. And you can get a very rapid, arbitrarily rapid rise of your employment statistics. So here the excision is being done by this collapse, which decreases constantly the effect of this lower range. And because collapse rate and like expansion rate is not bounded from below, so you can get very, very fast acceleration, in principle.
Well, this question is going to ask, isn't this an artifact of the definition of average? I mean, my question
to take
is that maybe it's
okay, but why should we? Yeah, so this is the simplest extension of the usual average people discuss that you. So what I'm doing here is I'm finding what is the proper time of co-moving observers, and then I'm taking the spatial average on hypersurfaces of constant proper time. Whether this is the correct one, you can indeed ask. But I said that I'm not going to discuss that now. However, because you cannot expand faster than this, there is an upper bound on Hubble parameter times time. Namely, it's bounded from above by 1. So in Freeman-Metz-Walker case, Q is, can be at, cannot be more negative than minus 1, but Hubble parameter times time can grow indefinitely, and here the opposite. First, the Humble parameter goes down because of the collapsing region, then it rises because of the underference. And if you can show with confidence and in a model independent way, then Humble parameter times time is more than one, then you have immediately ruled this model off.
So that HT is the full H.
Yeah.
Right. So it's nu1 plus nu2 times H2G.
Yeah. And in lambda CDM, both the acceleration and the increase in HT is done by lambda. But here the situation is quite different because the acceleration comes just from the fact that you are shedding slowly expanding regions. So you can have acceleration even though HT would go down. So the collapsing region gives the acceleration, but the increase in HT is given by the underdense region. So you need both of these regions in order to get these things right. Now, here, this is a toy model, and the question is, would this work in the real universe? How is this related to what actually happens? When I come back to the coincidence problem. So in the real universe, of course, doesn't consist of disjoint regions, which are overdense and underdense. But in fact, you have you do have overdense and underdense regions. These perturbations are nested inside each other. So the first one, say, stars collapse to form galaxies. So first you have a perturbation set aside of stars, which collapse and stabilize. And then the perturbations formed by these stars then, in turn, collapse to form bigger structures, and so on. And new perturbations are constantly entering the horizon. So there's part of the universe which is always collapsing, and there's part of the universe which is always becoming more empty. Now I think I forgot to answer your question about what stops this expansion. So any acceleration that you get by this mechanism can never be eternal. And physically, simply because acceleration is smoothed down in inhomogeneities, and so the acceleration will end. And it's actually plausible that in the real universe you could then have oscillations. Because what happens if you have acceleration, then the inhomogeneities are erased, then of course with new perturbations coming in from the horizon, so then you could start again. So it's possible that you could have a period between, which oscillates between extra deceleration compared to the primer of the water case and acceleration. And indeed, if this process of acceleration starts with the collapse of first objects around the redshift of 50 or so, then you have to have this kind of oscillation to agree with the data. However, as I mentioned earlier, there is actually a preferred size. Preferred timing structure formation which is related to the acceleration. So when the first objects collapse and they're very small compared to the horizon, then I'm not assuming cold dark matter. Normal cold dark matter, not axions, for example, which would be a difference. And then the size of these, then so these nested perturbations, then the objects are constant becoming bigger, but the horizons are also growing. But these structures are growing faster until you saturate, which happens when all of the perturbations that enter the horizon during the radiation-dominated era have collapsed. Then the system for a scaling variant primordial spectrum is completely scaling variant. Because what gives the difference of why it's growing is that the perturbations which enter during the radiation-dominated era have a lot lower amplitude than those which enter during the matter condition. So as you move, so as the collapse moves closer to the wavelengths which collapse during matter-dominated era, then the relative size rises because the amplitude of perturbations is bigger. And then you saturate that, so this is the inverse linear size of the structure square, which is the horizon size square, and you saturate around this level between 10 and 100 billion years. It's difficult to be specific both because, of course, you only approach this number asymptotically. So it depends whether you say 30%, 50%, 90%. And also because, for example, the BBKS fitting formula, which I use, is not reliable at long wavelength numbers. And at any rate, because when you start saturating, then what happens is that it takes a long time to go from 95 to 96%. So if you change your criterion from 90 to 95%, then you get a very large number because it approaches logarithmic. And one would expect, the size of the wavelength of perturbations which enter during the radiation-dominated era is about 100 H inverse megaparsecs. And besides the structures which are collapsing now, it's about 10 H inverse megaparsecs. So it's within an order of magnitude, or maybe the same order of magnitude, it's at least suggested. And we'll expect the departure from the framework of the Swarter equations is larger than the structures reach a maximum size. Of course, then you have to, not just question linear, it's also a question you have to look at how does the number density evolve. Okay. But in fact, if you, in the calculation I did, I had an overdense structure and the void. And the, when you go to initial times, then these over and unknown densities did not balance each other completely, which is what would happen in the real universe. The mean density is zero, far away, say, last letter. And in fact, if you do that, you don't get acceleration. What you instead have is that the expansion rate rises as voids under dense regions dominate more of the space. But you don't get acceleration. So what you would expect to be the more realistic calculation is that first the expansion rate just rises, and then you have a void-dominated background. And then we have the collapse of large objects on this background. Then you get acceleration. I'm already at the conclusion because there has been much less resistance than I expected. So, there are things which I would like to you to remember about this talk is that the Friedmann and Swarter equations do not describe the expansion of an homogeneous or an anisotropic space. And the equations which do describe it in the case of irrotational dust, the Buchert equations show that the local expansion, even though the local expansion decelerates everywhere, the average expansion can accelerate. Essentially because the contribution to the acceleration is not just the volume, it's not just the change in the expansion rates, but also the change in the volumes. So if you throw out the volume, which is expanding slowly, very rapidly, then of course your average acceleration goes up. And these two statements are not even physical. These are just simple mathematical statements about general relativity. Then,
so can I ask this?
Yeah.
Can you comment? Well, so you said you don't want to comment on using this as an explanation for the experimental observations at the supernovae. Mm. You don't want to. Because there's these papers, like I guess Wald's paper, that argues that this average should not be taken seriously. I guess.
Yeah. So.
Wald's paper is wrong.
That's what, I hear that statement, but there is this.
Okay, so.
yeah, I think it's obvious. Average,
So this is a very good point. Actually, maybe I will answer Wolf's criticism right here since I have time. So Wolf's paper he discusses. So there's a paper by Ishibashi and Wolf, the title of which can back reaction produce accelerated expansion. The first word in the abstract is no. And he discusses perturbations which are some horizons or smaller than the horizon and perturbations which are larger than the horizon. And I have nothing to say about regarding perturbations which are larger than the horizon, except that these Buchert equations show that in the case of dust, they cannot lead to acceleration, which everybody agrees. So then Wolf has three different arguments. And one is the argument that the result that one gets depends on how you choose the hypersurface of the constant proportion. And then he has a construction in Minkowski space where you can have a convoluted choice of hypersurface and see acceleration even though the space is just Minkowski space. So this statement is true but irrelevant. Because Minkowski space is maximally symmetric space. Of course, there is no preferred time, there is no preferred direction, no preferred hypersurface. In the region, in the Friedmann Walker universe, for example, you do have a preferred time, which is the proper time of four moving observers.
Still, That's a choice. A choice of four. I could choose
other
coordinates. These are all the gauges.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. So of course.
What do you mean by
prefer? I mean prefer.
That you prefer.
No, I mean that it is the time that we measure.
That's a gauge variant concept.
It's preferred by the CMB, right?
It can be measured. Okay.
So, and this statement is of course also true for the Friedman and Walker model, because it's true that this is just a coordinate. So if I want, I'm going to write Friedman and Walker in very strange coordinates.
Strange is an emotional feeling that you have. It's not a physical state.
Let me put it like this. I can write the Friedman and Walker model in coordinates where the expansion will have completely different. Right. So the Walker statement is true, but it is also true about the Friedman and Walker model. So this question of how do you choose the hypersurface proper time, I don't think there is a problem in this case. In some other cases, even back here, there is a problem.
For perturbations that reach the size of the horizon and are larger than the horizon, this becomes important.
Yeah, but as I said, I'm not going to say anything regarding long wave.
He
talked both about long wave.
Right. That's why he has to make this point.
So then people pointed out to him after the paper they released, he put the paper on the archives, but they released this preferred time which you use in the framework of Matsuwaka cosmology. Then Ishibashi and Wolf made the statement that that's true, but however, when you're looking at small scales, then you saw so that this is irrotation. You necessarily generate vorticity. For example, in galaxies, you of course have rotation. And then this coordinates that you are using will break down. This statement is true. It is also true of the Friedman and Walker. So what they're saying is that the back reaction of vorticity is important, and you should be careful about the definition of your time coordinate, because when you have vorticity, these hypersurface proper time, for example, do not cover the whole space. They don't mesh, so that you will use them in the way I'm using. This statement is correct. But from the fact that back reaction of vorticity may be important, it does not follow that back reaction without vorticity does not exist. So then we had a second, then they had a second problem, which was that because the universe is everywhere described by linear perturbation theory in your Friedman to Walker model, and the amplitude of these perturbations are small, back reaction is small. So this is wrong on both terms. Because even if the amplitude of the metric perturbations is small, you can still have large observable effects. Because the physical observables are not given just by the metric, but by the metric and its derivatives. And when you look at scales which are much smaller than the horizon, then the momentum by definition is large. And so you could have large effects.
Sorry, but you were. Nobody looks at metric perturbations as such. You always look at physical perturbations. You cannot look at metric perturbations. And the argument is that the perturbations in curvature are small. This is a physical statement that doesn't depend on the choice of coordinates.
No.
If the physical perturbation in character are small, the back reaction is small.
That is correct.
Okay.
But that is not the argument that they made.
I think that that's okay.
Okay, that's not what they wrote, at least in the first version of the paper. If they have since changed it to be more palatable, that's fine. But at any rate, the statement that the universe is everywhere described by linear perturbation theory, and this is, I gave this talk to Terminus, and there was Nicholas Nedin, a galaxy physicist, who very aggressively put forth the point of view that the universe is everywhere described by linearly perturbed Walker model. But if you think about it, it's obvious that because the galaxy is not expanding, the difference metric perturbation between the galaxy and the expanding regions is 100%. Of course, the gravitational potential is not large, but it is not the same as the metric perturbation. So actually asking, does he think that the size of the galaxy has increased, has expanded during the last 100 million years? And said yes. But I know that next time when I encounter a person like this, I will ask him, do you think that the size of the solar system has expanded during the last 100 million years? And I will ask, what about the dinosaurs? Have they become big?
Well, the papers about the Andrian haven't been changing because of that as well. And some people are persuaded. I thought it was something that's actually, anything smaller than the cluster would be expanding.
Anything smaller than the cluster? Yeah. Then there was a third argument by Wolf, which was that he actually had a similar construction as I had. You take a union of different Friedman to Walker regions, then you calculate the average acceleration, and then they notice that this is negative even though the expansion decelerates everywhere. So they concluded from this that this is unphysical and cannot work. But what they had demonstrated is exactly the back reaction can be. So the calculation is correct, but the interpretation is exactly the reverse. So these two mathematical statements. then possible relation to this is that acceleration is intimately related to collapse, because collapse, you get a region which falls, whose effect on the expansion rate is negative and dropping sharply. This stuff, one can get acceleration without collapse, but it's much harder to get the large Fermion deployment. And also the structure formation, which is a product of gravitational collapse, has a preferred time around the acceleration. But these are, this shows that there could be an effect and that maybe it's plausible. Also, one should note, this is, I'm not claiming that this is the explanation. What one should now do is to really look at the effect of real structure formation, the formation of real voids, and build a model where one can calculate these in detail and then compare to observation. And what you mentioned, that this metric assumption will definitely have to be checked. And for, as I said, for instance, last year there were papers in Astrophysical Journal looking at if you have clumps and then you look at the how light rays pass, and you look at the convergence and the divergence of null GODs extended precision under certain conditions, these two are very sharp, and you do find the, that you have the average scale back. But of course, I mean, you have to do this for the real observables that you want to use, cluster counts, luminosity distance, and diameter distances, which depends slightly differently on the method. So I'm not claiming that this is the answer, but I think this is quite a good question.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, I forgot to say about that. Yes, of course. So you also expect that. So this is only what I talked about the average, so in a way related to this. But of course, because I was, when I was giving talk on this, and people sometimes ask, OK, you're talking about the average. What does it have to do with us? We're sitting at one point here. We're not measuring the average. But of course, and that is true. This is, of course, also true for the Freeman and Walker model. So then you really have to look at what is the variance around this average, what's the probability of measuring one thing or another. And you would really expect to see effects on the expansion rate. For example, you would expect the universe to be slightly different in the north and the south, which would, for example, lead to, I mean, for example, there is the optical depth, at least in the first year of WMAP data, is, I can't remember which way it is. I think it's in the north, it's consistent with zero, and south is 0.17. Maybe it's the other way. And you also have a difference in the density of galaxies between the north and the south. And of course, in the lowest TMB multiples, you do see this directional. So, and these are the sorts of effects that we qualitatively expect to see. But of course, you know, you have to sit down and calculate and see what they really are. I'm not claiming that.
But it's even in the Hubble diagram,
Yes, of course. So, so from calculating this, you would expect that you would see the. Then you would be able to predict the directional variance of the expansion. And so in the paper by Gasparini, Bonvin, and Ducker, where they looked at Einstein dissipated universe with linear perturbations and calculated, they indeed calculated that the correction to the monopole is small. But then you can expand this expansion rate the same way as you do about CMB, and you got the power spectrum. And you can already, from those calculations, have a dipole, and you can predict what it should be and how it's related to the monopole. And it's at the level that you should be able to resolve it if you get these experiments which measure tens of thousands of supernovae. And from this also, you should calculate and see what it is.
So how big should the perturbations be so that we'll be able to get a acceleration? Can you quantify that?
Yeah. So. Well, I can quantify the number. First of all, one might worry that in order to get enough acceleration, the collapsing region needs to be very large, which is, of course, troublesome, because if you look at the collapsing regions that you have in the real universe, they certainly do not occupy more than at most 3% of the volume. But in fact, here, at this point, the volume of the collapsing region is 1%. If you want to look at it quantitatively in these terms of omegas, omega matter, and so on, then if you look at these equations, so this is also being discussed by Buchhoff, and you can take this as your Hubble law, and then you divide out by this so that you have omega. So you have omega matter, omega curvature, and omega back reaction. And in order to get the acceleration, this omega back reaction then needs to be of the order 1. And so from here, you can get that the variance in the overall variance in the expansion rate needs to be between 0.1 and 1, which means that that a significant fraction of the universe needs to be in voids, and then you need to have something collapsing. Whether this is in agreement with what is known about the structure formation, I'm looking into it, and I'm not sure which is the correct thing, because the definition of voids in simulations and in the observational papers are very different. And so in one paper, you find out that voids occupy by 100% of the volume, and in others, you find a statement that they're by 40%, because they are defined differently using different kinds of algorithms. So it is not implausible.
There's a general statement in modern cosmology that cosmology is like a hammer. What a hammer is, a hammer always sees a nail. So the modern cosmologist always sees a FRW. The reason for this is it makes quite simple. But there are people who know exactly what the incomplete solutions of Einstein's equations. And when you look at them, you have to assume assumptions about the degree of inhomogeneity, for example, they make it all in volume model. If you look at that, you find that when you average it, you always have to do it in the inhomogeneous universe, that you actually can allege the possibility of an accelerating universe on the average, particularly if you have a void. We know observationally that we have voids that are 50 to 100 megaparsecs in size. So if you have an observer sitting in the void, or near the void, and looking through it, then these exact homogeneous motions, the void acts like a cosmological constant, because it's expanding, and it accelerates the universe.
I thought that something like that has the equation of state of space curvature, which is negative, but just smaller than.
So I think the correct statement is that if you have a void, then that is correct. But if you have a variance, so if you're sitting on a, if you have also a collapsing area, then the change in the volume also contributes to this. But only with the void you cannot get it.
You can't take this into account correctly in a strictly FRW universe by doing computations. You have to look at the exact equations. And these exist in the literature. So as long as we insist on doing late time universe cosmology with FRW, we're treading on dangerous ground. And in particular, the issue of accelerating the universe is very important. It's one of the most important problems in modern physics. So we should carefully consider these possibilities before dismissing them.
A separate issue to the coincidence problem is the flatness question. And I can see how your modified Friedman equation with Q would affect the calculation of the critical density. So my question is, if you have the calculation of the critical density, then can you explain the flatness problem in the sense that in the voids, do you still have dark energy to fill the gap so that omega total is 1, and if not, what sort of fills that gap with that dark energy? Because you don't need dark energy to explain the acceleration.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. So omega is of course 1 by definition, by construction of the equation. So omega matter is by definition this divided by 3 times the Hubble parameter. So this is 0.2 or 0.3, then these contribute 0.8. And so this acts as your effective dark energy term. But what is important about the spatial flatness issue because is that now you see easily that so Q, the behavior of this spatial curvature which follows from the inequality condition between these two equations is not 1 over a squared, but instead it's related to this Q. So Q grows and this must go down. And so if you have a universe which is initially spatially flat, then as this back reaction becomes important, then you generate negative spatial curvature. And so a sort of firm prediction of this is that you have to have spatial curvature, otherwise it's not going to work. But whether or not that's forbidden from the CMB is a different issue, because this is not something that affects the universe for a long period of time, goes like 1 over a squared for something which is 0, and then very close to us, it jumps up. But of course, this is also something that one has to calculate, and might indeed be one of the simplest ways of proving this out.
Actually, if you do put the cosmological constant back into that equation, it's plus q plus lambda over 3. Right?
Yeah.
So it's completely equivalent.
Well, I mean, in formal terms, anything that you write is equivalent because you define the equation so that whatever is on the right hand side is 1, the sum of things on the right hand side.
Any more questions?